Good morning and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, June 18. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. Look for mostly sunny and breezy today with winds out of the south at 10 to 20, Cedar Rapids high of 88 and a low of 66, Iowa City high of 89 and a low of 67. The front page today, curbing youth violence pivots in pandemic. Care packages and porch outreaches among ideas. This story by Kat Russell for the Gazette. Thwarted by the coronavirus pandemic from launching the mentoring programs it intended, an organization seeking to curb youth violence has pivoted to other ways of helping this summer. The Creating Safe, Equitable, and Thriving Communities Fund is a partnership between the City of Cedar Rapids, Linn County, and the Cedar Rapids Community School District that grew out of wide-ranging discussions about addressing youth violence. At the end of 2019, the fund awarded 7 grants for proposals that largely focused on engaging at-risk youth with supportive mentoring and other programming. But because of the virus pandemic, much of the programming had to be canceled or changed. Many of these programs were centered on mentoring youth, matching youth with mentors, working with small groups, having discussions, providing peer support, learning conflict management skills, understanding history and who they are, said Rachel Rockwell, program officer for the fund at the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. So instead, the 7 grantees, along with other local nonprofit, government, and community organizations, have launched the Reset 2020 Youth and Family Challenge Summer Outreach Program as a way of adapting their work and helping families and individuals navigate the new realities and added stress that came with it. The Reset 2020 programming, Rockwell said, will narrow its focus to addressing the needs of specific at-risk families in the community and work to provide support and connect them to the most relevant resources. Rockwell noted that at-risk does not pertain only to violence, but includes families struggling with food insecurity, housing uncertainty, or dealing with the coronavirus or other issues. This is a way that we can all pivot and all work together toward one common goal, she said. Reset 2020 has chosen roughly 60 families, many of which were identified through the SET or SET-funded organizations, as well as through social services, the school district, and juvenile courts. Most of the households have a number of youths between 10 and 21 in the home, but lack the needed support. The families were identified using a set of 4 risk factors that included previous exposure to violence in the school, household, or neighborhood, previous behaviors that can lead to involvement with the criminal justice system, previous school suspensions, expulsions, and referrals to law enforcement, and having family members, including adults or other youths, who are or have been involved in the criminal justice system. So if one or more of those 4 factors is present, that's how we are assessing that and saying they potentially have elevated risk of being impacted by community violence, Rockwell said. The concerns are that some of the youth in these homes might lack the supports they may have gotten in school, or maybe they are not able to connect with positive adults, and with much of the city's summer activities canceled, they won't have access to the mentoring or activities that many of those programs would provide, she added. Based on research-based violence intervention methods, Rockwell said the Reset 2020 Youth and Family Challenge Program will include programming tailored toward these youth and families who are believed to be most vulnerable to violence. Efforts will include anti-violence messaging from credible community leaders, engagement through street outreach teams for regular check-ins, care packages and porch talks, incentives and awards for program participation, and reliable intervention methods. Over the summer, we're going to have a number of challenges for our Reset families, along with incentives for participating in the challenges and rewards for completing them, Rockwell said. The first challenge included a request for a 30 to 90 second video of a personal message of safety, peace, and hope for youth and young adults. Those videos have been posted online. The effort has engaged more than 40 youths so far and has 39 challenge participants, and Reset 2020 Facebook page has gained roughly 325 followers since it was launched in May. The real goal of this program is to keep these families safe, not just safe from community violence, but also to help keep them healthy, Rockwell said. When we talk about ways to keep our youth and families safe, we are not just talking about gun violence. Now our messaging includes best practices for preventing COVID-19 infection, where to turn for help during the economic crisis, supports for coping with unusual stresses, and how to stay safe while exercising rights to protest. Rockwell said the Reset 2020 program is the beginning of what she believes needs to be a community-wide response. What we ultimately want to see is a community-level response, and this is a start, but it's disconnected at this point from the full comprehensive response that I think is needed to really see a significant reduction in community violence, she said. But it's the beginning of preparing nonprofit organizations and community-level leaders to be able to do that work, because what we need is a multi-sector approach where community leaders, law enforcement, social services, and community members are all on the same page, and that we are working with one voice to one common goal, and that's to keep our community safe and to keep our youth safe and out of prison and alive. In another front page story, UI's fall semester, online after Thanksgiving, this story by Vanessa Miller. Although the University of Iowa is planning to follow its usual academic calendar this fall, it will switch to online-only instruction after Thanksgiving break, delivering final exams remotely, according to a return-to-campus plan made public on Wednesday. The state's two other public universities, Iowa State University and University of Northern Iowa, last week unveiled plans to start and end the fall semester earlier, sending students home the day before Thanksgiving. The earlier shift avoids having Thanksgiving and winter break only a few weeks apart and reduces exposure to the coronavirus that students could face in traveling back and forth. The UI plan addresses the issue by shifting classes to online, but its residence halls and dining services will remain open, quote, to serve those who rely on university services, end quote, according to a message from UI President Bruce Harold and Provost Monsi Fuentes. Additionally, the university will, from the start of the semester, avoid convening students in large lecture halls, providing courses of 50 or more online. UI classes involving clinical and experiential activities, such as labs, will be handled on a case-by-case basis, according to the message that addresses many details of an unprecedented fall that comes amid a pandemic that shut down the campus in mid-March. ISU administrators last week told the Gazette they opted to start the semester a week early, hold classes on Labor Day, and then end at Thanksgiving break because they didn't want to bring students back to campus after traveling home for the holiday. But they also wanted to offer an in-person component for the entire semester. None of the universities have disclosed potential changes for the spring. All three moved to virtual instruction in the middle of the spring semester as COVID-19 shut down much of the state. The continuing pandemic has lowered enrollment projections for the fall as students waver between coming back for a non-traditional semester and waiting for a safer degree of normal. Some students and families also are figuring economic and health woes into their decisions on whether to return, making the university's plans even more imperative. The campuses themselves are facing tens of millions of dollars in COVID-19-related losses, meaning any dip in students pining for a more traditional collegiate experience could exacerbate already deep financial pains. To say that we've missed you is an understatement, the message said to students. We look forward to seeing you this fall with all your energy and enthusiasm. In breaking down specifics of how the UI campus will look different this fall, officials highlighted changes in the classroom, residence, and dining halls, and other facilities and buildings. The UI plan did not address athletics practices or events for the fall and winter seasons. It did articulate general safety changes and requirements, including a mandate that students, faculty, and staff wear face coverings, such as masks or shields, in campus buildings and classrooms. The university, which in May issued a bid for up to 10,000 UI-branded masks, will provide every student, faculty, and staff member 2 cloth masks, 2 disposable masks, and 1 face shield, according to the fall plan. UI leaders also are asking people to stay 6 feet from others when possible and to stay home and report if they develop COVID-19 symptoms or test positive. The new rules will come with additional student, parent, and employee training, including expectations for social distancing and using protective equipment. The UI is looking into both diagnostic and immunity testing programs on campus and is coordinating with Johnson County Public Health on contact tracing efforts, which would allow the campus to take a systematic approach to quelling the potential spread by reaching out to individuals who unknowingly had contact with an infected person. The university is looking into technology support for contact tracing and is attempting to get on-campus and current addresses and contact information for all students to ensure timely communication. The UI will have campus testing available according to its plan and will provide isolation and quarantine space for COVID-19 positive students and close contacts. The university, like many college campuses across the nation, is offering a hybrid model of instruction this fall while, quote, prioritizing face-to-face instruction, end quote. Combining online and in-person instruction will allow the university to maximize use of its larger classrooms, while also following social distancing guidelines, officials said. To that end, the university will deliver all courses of 50 or more students online, although exceptions might be made if online instruction isn't feasible. It's prioritizing in-person instruction for classes with fewer than 50 students and is considering requiring assigned seating in class to help with contact tracing. University classrooms will be outfitted with additional cameras and audiovisual equipment to enhance the educational experience, according to the fall plan. Because administrators believe in the importance of creating connections for first-year students, the UI is prioritizing in-person instruction for first-year seminars, rhetoric and other English and creative writing courses, world languages, discussion and lab sessions for math and chemistry, and other general education discussions. Although the university traditionally offers triple and quad occupancy rooms, it will limit assignments to only single and double rooms while taking other measures to reduce density and support social distancing. It will, for example, reconfigure or close common spaces, limit visitors and guests to 1 at a time, and reserve space for emergency use, like the need to quarantine or isolate students. In its dining halls, the university will move to touchless payment, discontinue self-serve options, eliminate refillable containers, encourage online ordering, limit seating and move tables farther apart, install barriers to minimize contact with staff, and adopt employee screening steps. University libraries are preparing to reopen to faculty, students, and staff August 17 with new procedures that include contactless transactions, physical barriers, sanitizing stations, reduced seating, curtailed hours, and socially distanced workstations. Additionally, returned materials will be quarantined for a period of time. UI administrators are developing guidance for student groups that will, among other things, require gatherings of 50 or more to be held virtually, organizers to offer hybrid opportunities, and leaders to produce videos and content for incoming students looking to get involved at Iowa. And in a final front page story from the Gazette, remake police force, IC City Council agrees. This story by Lee Hermiston for the Gazette. Change is coming to the Iowa City Police Department. In response to days of local and national protests in the wake of the police officer killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Iowa City will come up with a plan before the end of the year to restructure its police department toward community policing, including but not limiting to reduction of the public's reliance on police in nonviolent situations through use of unarmed professionals. The commitment is among those unanimously approved at the end of a more than four-hour meeting Tuesday night, where the City Council affirmed its initial promise to address systemic racism and the demands of the Iowa Freedom Riders, a local group representing the Black Lives Matter movement. A majority of the group's demands pertain directly to either the City Police Department or the Community Police Review Board, which reviews citizen complaints against police officers. What a restructured police department would look like is unclear, since the council did not discuss the topic in depth. It committed to come up with a plan by December 15. Quote, "We won't abandon the core need for a local government to make its residents safe," end quote, said Councilmember Laura Burgess, who drafted the resolution. Burgess said armed police officers represent a significant impediment to some residents feeling safe. Having officers respond to some calls, she says, does not necessarily lead to a peaceful, successful de-escalation. Council member Janice Weiner noted that police officers must deal with mental health, the homeless population, and a whole variety of things that shouldn't be part of their duties. She and other council members called for looking at other cities that have made progress in restructuring their departments for ideas. Mayor Bruce Teague called for a closer look into the police department's budget, which the council approves annually along with the rest of the city budget. A detailed version of the budget was uploaded earlier this week to the department's website. "What we're going to be doing is going to be major," Teague said. City Manager Jeff Fruin urged the council to, quote, take a deep dive, end quote, into the department's calls for service to determine what could be best split off for a non-police response. Officers responded to more than 77,000 calls for service in 2019. "I think that's an absolute must going forward to inform the discussion," Fruin said. Councilmember John Thomas urged the council to view the plan it comes up with as preliminary. "Keep in mind that Minneapolis is allowing itself a year," Thomas said. "If we're going to achieve what I think we're going to achieve with this particular item, it may take longer." Other aspects of the resolution adopted Tuesday night include dedicating $1 million to racial equity and social justice, creating a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, or Commission, quote, "to bear witness to the truth of racial injustice in Iowa City and to carry out restorative justice," end quote. Having an independent review of the use of flashbangs and tear gas on protesters during their June 3 demonstrations, receiving a report on how to strengthen the Police Review Board, requiring police officers to use body cameras and intervene when excessive force is used by another officer, and making Juneteenth a city holiday. In a separate resolution, council members said they will urge the city and the Johnson County Attorney's Office to drop charges against protesters. Council member Susan Mims said she was not in favor of dropping some charges relating to public safety, such as speeding and drunken driving, but she was outnumbered by her colleagues, including Mayor Pro Tem Ma Zahir Saleh, who said protesters were unfairly targeted. Teague compared the criminal activity with what takes place during Iowa Hawkeyes' home football games. "We see it all the time," he said. "We see it for football games here. There's an allotment and acceptance of behaviors that would not be tolerated any other time. Once the game is over, behavior is back to normal. I support waiving all the charges given the event and the circumstances. Moving to the Iowa Today page, 53 counties now have COVID-19 deaths, 11 new cases reported in Johnson County. Dickinson and Keokuk counties Wednesday reported their first coronavirus-related deaths, bringing the total counties in Iowa with COVID-19-related deaths to 53. Another 10 deaths were reported, bringing the statewide total to 671 since mid-March. State public health officials also reported 211 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state total to 24,379. Johnson County reported 11 new cases, its first double-digit increase since May 6. Another outbreak has been reported at a long-term care facility at Pleasant View Home in Buena Vista County. An outbreak consists of three or more confirmed cases among residents and staff. Willow Gardens Care Center in Marion, where an outbreak was reported June 11, when 11 people were ill, reported that three people there have recovered. Of the 4,139 new test results reported Wednesday, 3,928 tested negative and 211 tested positive, for a 5.1% rate of positive cases for the 24-hour period. In another Iowa Today page story, UI's biggest college braces for cutbacks, this story by Vanessa Miller. The University of Iowa's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the largest on campus, has been asked to identify up to $25 million in cuts following massive coronavirus-related financial losses. That also follows a drop in state support and expected decline in the number of UI students this fall. The cuts probably will mean layoffs, lost pay raises, and potential furloughs or closed programs and departments. In a message to faculty and staff across the massive college, College Dean Stephen Goddard on Wednesday warned of the expected enrollment drop, a 13% decrease in non-resident students, and a 5% drop in residential students. The College of Liberal Arts and Sciences accounts for about two-thirds of the university's undergraduate student instruction and about half of its graduate-level instruction. The college had 15,749 undergraduates last fall, which was 607 fewer than it reported in the fall of 2018. It had 1,090 graduate students. The next largest college is the Henry B. Tippey College of Business, which had 3,138 undergraduates. Goddard announced three tiers of potential impacts tied to cuts in state support, noting the first tier would take effect July 1. He conceded that 86% of the college's budget goes to salaries and benefits, quote, making it difficult to identify sufficient cuts in places other than those that impact faculty and staff, end quote. The state appropriation cuts will be long-lasting, and we may never recover the funding once the deappropriation is made, he said in his message to colleagues. Iowa lawmakers during the weekend cut $8 million from the Board of Regents for the upcoming budget year. But Goddard noted additional cuts may be ordered during the year depending on state revenues. After reading the dean's message, UI English professor Lauren Glass acknowledged Goddard's efforts to be transparent, but took exception with the non-tenure track cuts. The other priorities seem reasonable, but we are disappointed by the absence of cuts to administrative salaries, he said. In the first tier of cuts, Tier 1 amounts to $15 million a year for 3 to 5 years and account for fewer students. Among the steps, eliminate January 2021 merit increases, eliminate 15 of 205 lecturers, which Goddard phrased as limiting the renewal of some instructional track faculty and assistants, cut pay for faculty members teaching additional courses, and for those who are converting courses from in-person to online, enable unpaid furlough days along with voluntary reduction in effort, defer non-critical instructional faculty and staff hiring, and cut visitor and adjunct faculty budget allocations along with the summer 2020 budget allocation. In the second tier of cutbacks, adding another $5 million could become necessary later in the upcoming 2021 budget year, depending on state appropriation decisions. Among these steps, cutting more instructional track faculty and assistants, quote, right-sizing, end quote, doctoral programs to meet shifting demand, eliminating duplication in majors and elective courses, cutting general education fund support for its English as a Second Language program, offsetting some student financial aid with donor-funded scholarships, expanding and leveraging shared research spaces, such as machine and electronic shops, and redeploying professional and scientific staff to meet changing needs. And finally, in the third tier, which could add another $5 million, are last resort measures in order of priority. First, temporary mandatory cuts in administrative supplements for senior leadership and directors, temporary mandatory cuts in summer executive officer salaries, closing or combining programs or departments, temporary mandatory cuts in staff and faculty salaries, and lastly, delayed faculty career development awards, such as research leave for 2 years. And moving to the Insight page, a community letter. This from Scott Rowland in Cedar Rapids. Citizen Review Board must have power. Police misconduct is a persistent and systemic problem. If left unchecked, it will gravely damage the legitimacy of government authority and the willingness of citizens to comply with the law. To address this problem, many municipal governments have created review boards that empower citizens to determine the outcomes of complaints filed against police officers. However, in many cases, these entities have become paper tigers. We cannot allow this to happen in Cedar Rapids. If a civilian review board is to be successful, there must be several conditions to make it robust. First, the board must be allotted a staff of investigators and legal professionals that ensure that justice is not miscarried. Second, it is imperative that the body is given subpoena power so that its investigative power is not reduced to commenting on an already completed internal investigation. Third, it should be allowed to review complaints submitted directly to the board, but more importantly, it should be given all initial reports that are received by the department, so that there can be no suppression. Fourth, for the sake of transparency, all proceedings of the board should be open to the public. Fifth, the organization should not be precluded from rendering a decision if there is litigation related to misconduct. Otherwise, this body will be sidelined because, based on precedent, it could take years before a settlement of a final judgment is reached. The city of Cedar Rapids must lead by example to raise public confidence. Again, that letter by Scott Rowland from Cedar Rapids. The 24-hour Doorman column is titled, A Moment in the Sun Turns to Darkness. If only the 2020 Iowa legislative session had ended on the sunny steps of the State House last Friday, with Governor Kim Reynolds capping a dramatic 24 hours by signing a series of police reforms. She was surrounded by lawmakers and Black Lives Matter activists who had filled the streets and marched in Capitol hallways demanding real change in the wake of George Floyd's death. Their loud, clear voices pushed the Republican-controlled legislature to, at last, move swiftly on a package of meaningful measures Thursday night without a dissenting vote. The bill places limits on the use of chokeholds by law officers, permits the Attorney General's office to prosecute officers whose actions result in death, and prohibits the rehiring of officers convicted of felonies or fired from serious misconduct. It would change officer training with more emphasis on implicit bias and non-confrontational methods. Reynolds made a rare appearance on the House and Senate floor as the bill was debated and approved. In the House, black lawmakers delivered stirring speeches. In the gallery, young activists and organizers watched a victory they made happen. So it could have been a satisfying ending. Lawmakers and Reynolds deserve credit for becoming part of the solution this time, with much tougher work still to be done in achieving racial justice. But the session didn't end there. Instead, the GOP General Assembly went back inside and spent the better part of the next 2 days reminding us of the bulldozer lawmaking that we've come to expect from the Golden Dome of Wisdom under current management. They couldn't shove a constitutional amendment forward, erasing Iowa women's right to an abortion, so they passed a paternalistic, constitutionally dubious gem forcing women to wait 24 hours before having an abortion. Republicans didn't even give Iowans 24-hour notice of their plans. Lawmakers threw up a procedural hurdle for the Secretary of State to send out absentee ballot request forms to all voters, as he did before the record-setting June 2 primary. Then they threw up a hurdle for voters by passing an ID requirement for absentee requests that will undoubtedly disenfranchise Iowans on a technicality. Few legislators draped themselves in glory during the final chaotic hours of a session. But our current Republican leaders have mastered the demolition exit, dropping surprise legislative bombs and escaping the statehouse before the smoke clears and Iowans figure out exactly what they did. 2 years ago, it was massive tax cuts and a sales tax increase swiftly passed before Iowans figured out its benefits mostly went to wealthy Iowans. Last year, the lawmakers voted to bar transgender Iowans from accessing needed care through public insurance and barred the Attorney General from joining lawsuits that might make the president look bad, as if he needs help. With so many pressing problems, amid a pandemic and recession, the legislature used its power in the end to play petty politics. We could have had sunshine, but we got the dark arts instead. Now they'll run fall campaigns about nothing. But don't forget, how they run the statehouse is truly something. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, June 18, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices from Marengo, June C. Head, age 95, died Wednesday, June 17. The Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting. From Toledo, Maxine D. Lucas, age 76, died Tuesday, June 16th. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, Toledo, is assisting. From Waukon, Lloyd H. Schulte, age 86, died Tuesday, June 16th. The Martin Funeral Home in Waukon is in charge. And from West Branch, Jean Vincent, age 85, died Tuesday, June 16th. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch is assisting. Moving to the longer notices, from Anamosa, June Grace Olfertz Topping of Anamosa died Wednesday, June 17, at her home surrounded by family. The family would like to thank Above and Beyond Hospice Care for the wonderful care she received. A memorial has been established in June's name. From Cedar Rapids, Connie L. Mead, age 70, died Tuesday, June 16th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 19 at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. All guests are asked to provide a mask and maintain social distancing. Private family interment will be in Anderson Cemetery near Swisher. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids are in charge. A full obituary will be in Friday's paper. Again, that's Connie L. Mead. From Marion, Beverly Joan Kriegel, age 86, passed away on Saturday, June 13, due to cancer. A private memorial for family and friends will be held at a later date. Again, Beverly Joan Kriegel from Marion. From Ryan, Ambrose John Hellman, age 90, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, June 16, at his home after a 7-year battle with bone cancer. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 20, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Ryan, with the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation is from 2 to 8 Friday, June 19th, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, where there will be a private scripture service at 1 p.m. There will be no public visitation prior to Mass on Saturday morning. Interment with military rites will be at the Calvary Cemetery in Ryan. Again, that's Ambrose John Hellman. From Vinton, Charles E., known as Chuck Peterson, age 72, died Tuesday, June 16th, at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester after a courageous battle with leukemia. Private Mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Vinton with Father Jim Brockman as celebrant. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 on Friday, June 19th, at the Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home in Vinton. Private family burial will be in Oak Hill Cemetery, Belle Plain. Again, that for Charles E. Chuck Peterson. And finally, from Webster, John Edward Laun died June 16 from complications of Agent Orange at his home near Webster at the age of 74. A celebration of life service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, June 20, at the Powell Funeral Home in North English. Burial will be at the Sordon Cemetery near Webster with military rites. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Friday at the Powell Funeral Home. Again, that notice for John Edward Laun. And from the Iowa City Press Citizen, one obituary, that for Jens Strand, age 74, of Coralville, passed away peacefully from complications of multiple system atrophy, known as MSA, a Parkinsonian disorder. He passed away at home in Coralville on Monday, June 15. Moving to the sports page, in high school baseball, Stensland, a Pirates coach, a Lions dad. This story by K.J. Pilcher for the Gazette. In Albernett, Ryan Stensland originally thought he would miss a milestone moment. He is in his fourth season as Albernett head coach, while his twin sons, Isaac and Lincoln, are eighth graders in the Lisbon baseball program. They didn't expect to be together for the boys' high school baseball debut about a month ago. As luck would have it, Stensland was there. He just happened to be in the opposing dugout when the younger duo took the field for the JV game. I told my Albernett guys that I probably know how Darth Vader felt when he faced Luke Skywalker, Stensland said with a laugh. It was a weird sensation. We didn't try to make a big deal out of it. I'm proud for them competing. The game against Lisbon was just the start of a challenging first week for the Class 1A 7th-ranked Pirates. Albernett opens with competition on each of the season's first 4 days, including 2 consecutive days against teams ranked in Class 1A preseason polls. The opening night was special for Stensland, who lives on a farm outside of Lisbon and previously coached the Lions to 250 victories and 3 state tournaments. He returned to the diamond with the Pirates, who field a strong nucleus from last year's state runner-up team. Of course, getting to watch his sons play was an added bonus he didn't expect until the baseball season was delayed and jeopardized by the COVID-19 pandemic. Family attended the game to watch both teams, with Isaac getting the start on the mound. Stensland joked that he was just relieved his wife, Abby, a Lisbon school board member, chose to sit on his side. That was an interesting first night, Stensland said. It just worked out that they played us and I got to watch them play. It was cool for my family to be there and get to watch all of us. It was a 2-for-1 deal that night. The family has a competitive streak. Stensland said the family is constantly trying to outdo each other, noting his youngest daughters, Ella and AJ, might be the biggest competitors in the group. They shared some good-natured ribbing. Stenslin noted that he told the boys to watch for high and tight pitches. He balanced being Pirates coach with being a Lions dad during the contest. I told them at the end of the day, they're still my boys, and I'm proud of them no matter what, Stenslin said. They were pretty excited about it. That was supposed to be a mid-season gauntlet to ramp up competition and prepare for the postseason, not the jump-in head-first slate as it has turned out to be with the late start and abbreviated season. But Al Burnett started with success, edging the Lions 2-1 in the varsity contest at home. They traveled to Mason City Newman on Tuesday night, falling 9-3 in a rematch of last year's state title game. Things didn't get easier Wednesday with a home game against number 6 Don Bosco. The stretch closes with a Tri-Rivers Conference doubleheader Thursday at Maquoketa Valley. This is a busy week for us, Stenslin said. Friday we're probably all going to take a big sigh of relief. The Pirates won 34 games last season and made their first state baseball finals appearance. They have plenty of talent, including All-Staters Reed Stallman, Hunter Caves, and Austin Huber. Caden Evans, Shane Neighbor, and Grant Sukup, and Andrew Osman are among some of the other leaders, looking for another strong showing. Stenslin said many have been starting since their freshman or eighth grade season. They have a lot of experience, Stenslin said. I think they're learning now that they have a pretty wide target on their backs. They realize that every night the teams are going to bring their best effort to try to beat us. We have to rise to that level, and hopefully they will keep working to get better every day. They're a great group of guys. I think they're hungry for postseason. And in another sports story, LeClaire named the Kennedy coach, this in prep wrestling. Cedar Rapids Kennedy Activities Director Aaron Stecker confirmed Wednesday that Nick LeClaire is expected to be the Cougars' next head wrestling coach, pending board approval. The interview committee sat down and looked at Nick's experience and his vision for the program through the transition from 3 to 5 years ago and what he wants it to look like, Stecker said. We've seen what he's built in our junior Cougar wrestling program, and it all just fit. LeClaire has served as an assistant on the Kennedy wrestling and softball teams. He worked with former wrestling coach Dennis Heineck, who resigned after last season. I feel pretty invested in the program, LeClaire said. I think we had it going in the right direction under Heineck's leadership. I'm excited to keep it going. LeClaire was a 2007 state champion for North Lynn. He started his college career at the University of Iowa before transferring to Coe. He was a 2-time NCAA Division III finalist and 3-time All-American for the Cohawks. We had some good folks to look at, Stecker said. It wasn't an easy decision to differentiate, but we're excited about Nick and his potential as head coach. It's in his blood and his family's blood. That story by K.J. Pilcher for the Gazette. And if you're able to listen on the radio today, here are some sports events. High school softball, West Delaware versus Mount Vernon, is to be broadcast at 5 p.m. on KMCH. That's 94.7. And in high school baseball, West Delaware versus Independence. That game at 7:45 p.m., again on KMCH. And local talk shows, gym classes at 3 p.m., KGYM. Todd Bromelkamp show with Alex Kuhn is at 4 p.m. On Press Row, also at 4 p.m., is on 1540 a.m. Moving to the Business 380 page. Quaker Oats to retire the Aunt Jemima brand. Cedar Rapids made product is to see a new name in late 2020. The famous Aunt Jemima syrup made by the Quaker Oats Company in Cedar Rapids and sold in grocery stores across the country soon will have a new name and logo. PepsiCo, parent company of Quaker Oats, said in a news release Wednesday it is making the change to, quote, make progress toward racial equality, end quote. The Aunt Jemima brand, in existence for more than 130 years, has faced scrutiny for portraying black women in a role of serving white people in previous advertising. The original Aunt Jemima model in the ads was born a slave. Criticism of the Aunt Jemima brand has intensified following the death of George Floyd, the 46-year-old black man who died while in Minneapolis police custody. Quote, "We recognize Aunt Jemima's origins are based on a racial stereotype," said Kristen Kropp, chief marketing officer for Quaker Oats. "While work has been done over the years to update the brand in a manner intended to be appropriate and respectful, we realize those changes are not enough," end quote. The brand also is donating at least $5 million between now and 2025 to create meaningful, ongoing support and engagement in the black community. The change will hit grocery store aisles in the fourth quarter. The Aunt Jemima image has been updated over the years to move it away from the original slave figure. A 1968 makeover replaced a kerchief on her head with a headband. In 1989, she got a gray streaked hairstyle without a headband, plus pearl earrings and a white collar. Earlier this year, Land O'Lakes announced changes to its packaging for butter and cheese products to remove the image of a Native American woman. That new packaging is expected to be fully rolled out by the end of this year. Mars, owner of the Uncle Ben's Rice, said the brand, which was had featured the likeness of an elderly black man for more than 70 years, will, quote, evolve, end quote, in response to concerns about racial stereotyping. Carolyn Sherman, a Mars spokeswoman, said the company is listening to the voices of consumers, especially in the black community, and recognizes that now is the right time to alter the brand, including its visual identity. In another Iowa Today story, DNR officials say, stop bugging the bear roaming through Iowa cornfield. Animal has been drawing crowds near Eldridge. A black bear that has been spotted wandering through eastern Iowa cornfields is drawing crowds of people, potentially posing a danger to the animal, as well as tickets for those seeking a glimpse of the bear. The adult bear showed up in cornfields in Clinton and Scott counties in the past few days and has been spotted munching on corn and taking frequent naps. Bears once were native to Iowa, but now mainly inhabit the northwoods of Wisconsin and Minnesota, as well as parts of South Dakota. The bear likely made its way to eastern Iowa via the Wapsipinicon River, which flows from southeastern Minnesota through eastern Iowa to the Mississippi River. It last was spotted in a field near Eldridge, and photos of it have been popular on social media. Sightseers are getting too close to the bear and are interfering with efforts to let it head back north, so officers could issue citations, said Jeff Harrison, an Iowa Department of Natural Resources officer. There are concerns the bear could wander over to Interstate 80, where it would be a hazard to motorists. If that happens, officers may have to kill the animal. Officers also are considering shooting the bear with tranquilizer darts, then driving it to forested areas along the Mississippi River in northeast Iowa. Quote, unfortunately, with social media, everybody that has seen the bear wants to photograph the bear, wants to take part with the bear, Harrison said. What they would do is follow it, track it, stalk it, end quote. Harrison said bear sightings in Iowa have increased in recent years, though he's never seen one in Scott County. In the last 5 years, we're probably receiving 2 to 3 reports a year now, whereas 10 years ago, maybe once every 2 years. And in another Iowa Today story, Maquoketa newspaper seeks police body cam footage. Open record case involves a 911 call. The assistant county attorney with beer cans in the car. A judge will decide if Maquoketa police must release police body cam footage from a 911 call involving assistant Jackson County attorney Amanda Lessence. 7th Judicial District Judge Don John Talene on Tuesday heard arguments in the lawsuit brought by Sycamore Media, owner of the Maquoketa Sentinel Press, against the city of Maquoketa to obtain police officer body cam footage taken just after midnight the morning of April 6, 2019. The Sentinel Press first reported on the 911 call involving license that month when Clinton County Sheriff's Deputy Andy Peterson cited her and her companion, Nick Shannon, for having open containers in Lassenson's car after responding to Shannon's call to Jackson County Dispatch. According to dispatch records, Lassenson's car was parked along Highway 61, just south of the Clinton-Jackson County line. Shannon told police Lassens had attacked him. Lassens, according to police reports, was sitting in the driver's seat of the parked car when police arrived with beer cans strewn about. Because she was slurring her speech and her eyes were bloodshot and watery, Peterson wrote in his report that he was prepared to administer a sobriety test, but after Lassens told him she had been drinking after she had stopped the car, he changed his mind. Peterson wrote in his report he believed Lassens' account and that drinking after a car is stopped would make the case difficult to prosecute. At least six police units responded to the 911 call. Deputies from Jackson and Clinton counties and officers from Maquoketa and Bellevue police departments. Lassens and Shannon both pleaded guilty to Clinton County citations of having opened containers of alcohol in a vehicle. At issue this week is whether releasing the body cam footage serves the public's interest more than keeping it secret. Under the state's open records law, the police department has the burden of proving why the video should not be released. The Sentinel Press's attorneys, Molly Parker and Sam Jones of Shuttleworth and Ingersoll in Cedar Rapids, argued during the 40-minute remote hearing that the investigation is concluded, no confidential information is involved, and the names of both parties involved in the dispute, as well as the details, have been made public. None of those factors weigh in favor of continued confidentiality of records that are in the department's possession, Parker said. They all weigh in favor of the fact that there will be no public harm suffered by disclosing of those records. Attorney Matthew Novak of Cedar Rapids, representing the city of Maquoketa, said Maquoketa police officers were not in charge of the investigation and responded first to the emergency call only because they were closer to the scene than any other officer. Because they were not involved in deciding what charges were filed, their body cam footage should be exempt, Novak said. He also argued that if the footage were released, the newspaper's interest in sensationalizing the incident would discourage domestic violence victims in other cases from coming forward. Talene, the judge, noted the case involves officers of the law and possible favoritism. He questioned Novak as to why the public should not be able to see for itself what happened rather than just taking the city's word for it. Likewise, he questioned Parker on whether releasing the video would have a chilling effect on other domestic calls. Talene will file a written ruling later. The newspaper filed the lawsuit in November in Jackson County District Court after Police Chief Brad Coranda in June 2019 refused to release the electronic footage sought by the Sentinel Press. The newspaper appealed to the Maquoketa City Council to intervene before filing the lawsuit, but the request went unanswered. Travis Mayfield, publisher for the Sentinel Press, said the newspaper filed the lawsuit because it believes the public has a fundamental right to records that show how public officials conduct themselves. He also added that the paper does not routinely report on domestic disputes. Quote, the reason we have covered this story so closely has nothing to do with the domestic dispute, Mayfield said. We believe the public interest in this story is tied to questions about whether or not local law enforcement did their job the same way they would have for any ordinary citizen, end quote. The Sentinel Press received footage taken by Clinton County Deputy Peterson's dash cam after an open records request was initially denied. It showed Peterson dropping lessons off at the Jackson County Courthouse, where she spent the night in her office. Peterson can be heard in the video telling lessons to make sure she does not get into the sheriff's office because, quote, they don't want you to get in more trouble than you already are, end quote. The newspaper also received about 5 minutes of footage recorded by Jackson County Deputy Chad Reeder, who was on the scene for 37 minutes. The footage from the Maquoketa Police Department is the only remaining video that has not been released publicly. Bellevue police officers do not wear body cameras. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. For today, Thursday, June 18, I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.